The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Addictions, Drug, and Alcohol Institute at the University of Washington has issued a new report entitled Unmet Needs, Complex Motivations, and Ideal Care for People Using Fentanyl in Washington State, a qualitative study. We'll hear about this new report on today's show. But first...
I am Haven Wheelock. I am the Harm Reduction Manager at Outside Inn in Portland.
What are safer smoking supplies?
Yeah, so safer smoking supplies can be different things to different people. In this context, we are talking about smoking supplies for illicit drugs. The conversation around safer smoking in regards to things like cannabis and nicotine is a different conversation. But in terms of when we're talking about smoking supplies for more stigmatized drugs like heroin, fentanyl, methamphetamines, cocaine, we're talking about distributing things like glass pipes, filters for like char and filters to keep drugs and to smoke drugs with. That also includes things like aluminum foil and straws that people use to smoke substances off of.
This kind of sounds like a silly question to ask because I grew up with both of my parents smoking two packs of cigarettes each every day. So,
which kills more people than all other illicit substances combined.
And had me wheezing all the way through high school when I finally moved until I finally moved away. But why do people smoke illegal drugs?
Smoking is one of the many ways that people put drugs into their body, right? Many drugs can be eaten, can be smoked, can be snorted, can be booty bumped. There's a lot injected. There are a lot of ways that people get drugs into their bodies. And smoking is one of the faster ways to do that. It is also one of the safer ways in terms of being able to control how much of a substance you're taking at a time. So if I am smoking something and I take a hit of it and I'm like, ooh, I'm good, I don't have to finish the rest of that dose in that moment. I can save it for later. I can get rid of it. Whereas if I eat a pill, if I inject something, that entire dose is now in me and therefore like I can't do less of it, right? Whereas when I'm smoking, I can do a hit, see how I feel, and then make the determination if I want to do more or not. It's similar to like the difference between like sipping a beer and doing a shot.
Are people smoking fentanyl? It's an opioid.
Yeah. So it's actually been a fascinating thing to watch. I've been working with people who use drugs for 20 years and like the goal of getting people to transition from injecting something to smoking something is a really hard sell. But as fentanyl has come onto the market with fentanyl compared to the heroin they were doing previously, and people have really transitioned from injecting heroin to smoking fentanyl. We've seen the number of visits to our syringe service program decline. The number of syringes we give out has dropped dramatically over the last 2 years. And so people really are making that transition in part because they don't want to die of overdose. Additionally, you know, poking yourself hurts. Right? Like people, like it is a more pleasant experience to be able to smoke something as opposed to have to inject it.
Well, and not to put too fine a point on it, but one of the reasons syringe services programs started in the first place was to prevent the transmission of HIV. And that's,
I mean, there are so many, like if there's so many like benefits to smoking versus injecting in terms of HIV transmission, hepatitis C transmission, things like endocarditis, osteomyelitis, skin and soft tissue infections. Like it is a safer route of transmission than injecting. Period.
And of course, we're not saying that everything, that anything is necessarily risk-free. That's say, it's all these things are relative, but
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like the safest way to do fentanyl is to not do it, right? And like being able to engage people who are smoking fentanyl currently and like help connect them to care while they're like, when people come in, we are able to like engage them in understanding their health care, understanding what's going on in their bodies, help them connect to care if that is what they want. And like being able to like build those relationships and that trust and like create that pipeline for folks who create that pathway for folks to engage in care and like possibly get on medicine or possibly go to treatment or any of those things. Like we want to do that. And if we can keep, and we want to do that ideally before they transition to injecting or transition back to injecting is probably the more realistic way to frame that, since so many folks have transitioned from injecting heroin to smoking. It's like, it's not inevitable, but it is a terrifying thought, that people are starting to and will continue to increase injection.
This is a little bit off topic, but I am curious. Xylazine's all over the news. We're seeing instances of it in various places around the country. Have there been any reports of xylazine or of just unexplained skin wounds and abscesses and such among folks in our area here around Multnomah County?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have had one confirmed xylazine and fentanyl related deaths in Multnomah County that was reported several months ago. It was a death from September, back in September, because our death data is incredibly slow. So knowing what people are dying from is a slow thing. That's a whole different beast. But based, we're not seeing a lot of evidence of xylazine in our community right now, based on our drug checking data. We are not really seeing xylazine. We have had a couple samples that like pe of people intentionally searching out xylazine, but it is definitely not, we are not looking at what they're looking at in Philly.
And there was another thing, which is I'm seeing in places like Vancouver, BC, and seeing it showing up a few other areas with benzodiazepines being thrown into the mix as a contaminant with some of the some of the opioids. Are you seeing any of that down here?
We are not necessarily seeing benzos in the opioids. We are seeing opioids in the benzos. So we are seeing like illicit pills that are being sold as benzodiazepines that do contain fentanyl, but we are not really seeing it the other way around.
I know that naloxone is a lot easier to get than it was,
Yeah.
and but I also know that I'm sure at least that a lot of people still aren't aware of how they can get naloxone if they need training and such. I was just doing an interview with someone up in Washington. I didn't realize, but they actually have a the state of Washington actually has a thing where people can get free naloxone from the state. Which, I mean, talk about making it nice and simple and easy to save a life. But how can people in the state of Oregon?
Yeah, if you want, it's in, if you want to address our addiction crisis and our overdose crisis, having naloxone is an important tool that all of us can have, to respond in the event that somebody is overdosing. In Oregon, you can get naloxone from any pharmacy without a prescription. Most insurances will cover it, not all. Thank you, US-based healthcare system. You can also get it from harm reduction programs, including outside in, if you want naloxone.
And does it require some kind of like, it doesn't require much training, right? It's self-explanatory stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is no required training. I believe that everyone should have their questions answered always and make sure they know how to identify an overdose and are prepared to use the medication. But most pharmacies are giving out a nasal spray that is really easy to use. That is actually going over the counter in the near future. So it's safe enough and easy enough to use that the FDA said it could be an over-the-counter medication.
I have heard stories of people seeing someone sort of groggy and mistake in trying to force doses of naloxone on them when they're actually conscious and as I understand, that would be basically a no-no. How would people tell the difference if they come across someone who appears to be appears to be unconscious? How would they know if naloxone was necessary? Yeah.
So overdoses are breathing emergencies and people stop breathing as a result of an overdose. That's the mechanism of danger and death is hypoxia. And so it is not hyperventilating. It is not feeling dizzy, which is things that are said sometimes in the media. If you come across someone and you're unsure, the first thing to do is try and wake them up. If someone can tell you they're okay, they don't need naloxone. If they're breathing enough to be like, yeah, I'm good, leave me alone. That's okay. Leave them alone. It's fine. It's really what you're looking for is people's lips and skin changing colors, turning blue, pale, gray, ashy. Not breathing is a big one, unresponsive to sound and pain. Those are the big ones. But if someone is telling you they're okay, please do not give them naloxone. It is not helpful and possibly assault if they tell you no and you do it anyway.
So if the police officer's just leaning against his car, hyperventilating, it's more likely a panic attack than exposure to some.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this misconception that somehow fentanyl is dangerous to people who are not using it, and that's not I'm not saying it's not a dangerous substance because it is for the people who are using it. It is not a dangerous substance to be in proximity of to touch. Our skin does a good job of keeping it out if you touch fentanyl. Wash your hands if you're worried about it, but it's not dangerous in that way. If you're hyperventilating, it is not an opiate overdose.
Any closing thoughts for our listeners?
One, thank you, Doug, for always inviting me on and helping to clarify the misinformation that is happening and supporting harm reduction in the work we do. That's a big closing thought is I really appreciate you for bringing this up and having this conversation. Harm reduction saves lives. And as much as we do need, our people who are mad about what we're doing right now are often being we need more treatment. We need more detox. We need more on-demand services. And they're not wrong. But those things are going to take time to create. And harm reduction is here to keep people alive while we do that work as well. It is not that or this. It is all of it. And so if anyone questions why harm reduction is important, we are pro-treatment. We are pro-access to treatment. We are not we want to help people be as healthy as they can be and they want to be. And we also acknowledge that it is really hard to get into treatment right now, and no one should die while we wait. And we don't want people to die waiting for that other, much more expensive, much bigger lift to happen.
How can people find you folks on the web and social media and support your work? And as long as I'm asking in full disclosure, I'm an occasional donor to Outside In myself.
Thank you. Yeah, outsidein.org is our website. You can donate there. You can volunteer there, sign up to volunteer. We highlight the good work we do as an agency. Our harm reduction program is just a small piece of a very big, cool, and comprehensive organization that does a lot of really great work. Across the board, not just around drug user health, but we do some really awesome stuff. We are on Instagram and Facebook, Outside In Portland, I think is, you can search it, you can find us.
That was my conversation with Haven Wheelock, Harm Reduction Services Manager at Portland area nonprofit Outside In. Find them on the web at outsidein.org. That's outsidein.org. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Addictions, Drug and Alcohol Institute at the University of Washington has issued a new report entitled Unmet Needs, Complex Motivations, and Ideal Care for People Using Fentanyl in Washington State, a qualitative study. ADAI held a webinar recently with three of the co-authors. Let's hear from Allison Newman, MPH, a program operations specialist with CDER.
So we did ask people, how interested are you in stopping or reducing your fentanyl use? This is a question we've asked on our syringe services program survey in the past. In this particular case, 70% of people said that they were interested in reducing or stopping their fentanyl use. 27% said they were not interested, and 3% said they were not sure. And this is pretty in line with our past syringe services program surveys, where a large proportion of people who used opioids said they were interested in reducing or stopping their use. So given that most people would like to stop or reduce their use, what kind of services are they interested in? We wanted to know, you know, given why people use, what kind of things would help them? We asked them about specific services and ideal care. And some of the big takeaways from that are that people wanted a range of different physical and mental health services and help with basic needs. And that what's most important, care that's accessible and non-judgmental. And we'll get into that a little bit more. So about halfway through these interviews, we pulled out this long list of different services and asked people, what services would you want if they were easy to get? And asked if they were interested, not interested, or not sure. This is definitely something you can check out in more detail in the report. The big summary here is people were very interested in different services to meet their basic needs for things like housing, cash assistance, employment support, phones. Also interested in harm reduction supplies. I think pretty notably, people were very interested in contingency management for their fentanyl use. And the area where people were the least interested in kind of things was in more traditional substance use disorder counseling. And just need to make a note that no one knew what one-on-one harm reduction counseling was, which is why we put an asterisk right there. But another big takeaway is people are really interested in a lot of different things. So it's important that we make sure that there is like a range of things that people can try. So we asked people to describe your ideal place to get help with your health and or substance use, and then ask them about some specific domains around that. And some background is we really wanted to talk about care versus treatment. Treatment for many people is like a very loaded term and has a specific connotation. And we wanted to know more broadly than treatment, what kind of things people thought would help them. As far as services and supports, people wanted physical health care, mental health care. It needed to be accessible in terms of location, cost, access, you know, hours, things like that. People wanted a place that might also provide a sense of purpose or activities that were an alternative to using fentanyl. People wanted help with basic needs. A few people talked about wanting access to safe supply. And a few people talked about wanting transition supports. So something that could help them reintegrate if they did stop using fentanyl. And I really like this quote because I think it gets at a lot of what people talking about. Someone described wanting just a place where you can calm your mind and relax and kind of be at peace. I think a lot of times, a lot of people, myself included, cannot be comfortable in the world or in our bodies or experiencing life. So just a place, a reason to be more comfortable with that, with less drug use or dependence on substances to have that comfort, I guess. So we asked people, you know, if the in this ideal place, who would the providers be? Who are the ideal types of people that you'd want to have helping you? And people talked a lot about, you know, having mental health counselors, physical health care providers, social workers. And what came up most frequently was having staff with lived experience. So someone said to have somebody who's already been through it to show us that there is light at the end of that dark tunnel. And this came up really frequently throughout these interviews. People really wanting someone who understood their situation, was not going to judge them, and could be compassionate. And sometimes that came up in contrast to what people had experienced previously with different care settings or different treatment settings where maybe they hadn't had a good experience, had been judged or not treated compassionately. So I think this is a nice summary. Someone said, who would work there? A psychologist, a doctor, staff members, secretary, and the clinical workers, social workers, providers. And I think what that captures is people really want like a one-stop shop with a mix of different people who can help them. So we asked about the physical location, what that would be like. We asked what the vibe would be and what the rules would be like. Many people describe wanting care in a homey space or a cozy space. I think several people use the words cozy and contrasted it with more like rigid, cold, or sterile environments. People wanted the place to be easy to get to and have flexible hours. Said it's really important that it be somewhere that you know you can easily get into, you don't have a long wait, and that it shouldn't have rigid rules. Some people talked about the benefits of having rules and guidelines as a way to sort of guide them, but other people talked about really the big drawbacks of being kicked out of a program if they either had a recurrence in use or broke other rules. So having rules that are, you know, accommodate people and are flexible for them. This one person said, that's not like a facility, but not an institution or something, but I don't know. I would just think a place should be like a house. You know what I'm saying? So you feel like you're at home. And I think this is a really evocative quote. Nobody is going to do it unless they really wanted to. So there's no need to be so pushy. So really that motivation has to come from that person. And then this quote was referencing the vibe. It says the general vibe would be acceptance and love, and you don't have to hurt yourself to not hurt here. Because all of that is hurting yourselves out there. You're safe here. So having a space that's really, for many people, homey, or a few people wanted care at home. One person wanted care, like actually two of the people wanted care at home with their families. And then having a space that is like really accepting, a vibe that is, you know, safe for people. So we did also ask people about the medications for opioid use disorder. There's a lot more about this in the report, and it's a complex topic. I'd say people were generally interested in methadone and buprenorphine, but perceived really significant barriers to accessing those. Methadone, especially, people talked about how difficult it was to have to go every day or to travel very far to obtain methadone, and that a lot of the rules and regulations around it meant that it wasn't really an option for them. One person said, if they had a methadone clinic closer to my home, I wouldn't have to drive an hour and a half, 2 hours every day to get to it. Or if they gave out a week doses at a time, that'd be cool. Another person talked about wishing that methadone was obtainable just like any other drug at a pharmacy. So they would try methadone if they could just get it like any other medication at a pharmacy, but they weren't interested in the different things they would have to do to access methadone the way it is now. A few people mentioned concerns about buprenorphine causing precipitated withdrawal for fentanyl use. People were unsure whether it would be a good medication for them for fentanyl. Many people had tried it previously, but that was more common for heroin. And many people talked about wanting to try a medication, but as a way to not be on anything at all in the future. So this person said, because the key is to not have to use anything else out there, and eventually maybe not even need to use some of the things that are here, the Suboxone and stuff. But that's one step at a time. So I think one of the takeaways from this section is that there's really serious barriers to people accessing these medications, and that for Suboxone, there may be a need for increased education for this population about Suboxone and also, you know, figuring out what might really work for this population. So that was our section on ideal care. There's so much more in the report. I think it was really wonderful to have the opportunity to ask people what they thought would work for them, which isn't something that we always do in healthcare. And it was felt really great to be able to ask people what they thought would really be effective. So what are the big things that we learned here? You know, I think Everett and Teresa highlighted a lot of these, but in our conversations as we were developing this report, it kept coming up like, how is this any different? How is this different than heroin? One of the things is that people have reported a huge shift in the drug market from heroin to fentanyl around 2020. This really affected them pretty hugely. A big summary of how it affected them, people are really afraid of overdose and dying. And this came up a lot more than it did in previous rounds of interviews that we did. You know, I did interviews in 2018 and 2021, and overdose didn't come up all that frequently. But in this situation, people talked a lot about overdose and dying and having known many people who had died from overdose. So this is a group of people who are experiencing, you know, deaths of friends and loved ones really frequently, and that is really affecting them. Another big shift is the move from injecting to smoking and the perception that smoking is a way to reduce overdose risk. I think it's really important to note that, you know, in Washington and in other places, a large proportion of overdose deaths do appear to involve smoking. So we know, you know, it's still possible to die from overdose from smoking. So we really think future research should dig into how to keep people safe from overdose when smoking and how to educate people about the potential risks of smoking. I think the biggest thing we notice is that gap between what people need and what's available is really wider than ever. And it's even more critical that we really address it as quickly as we can. You know, fentanyl exacerbates all the things that are challenging about opioid use disorder due to its potency and half-life. And we still haven't built a system where everyone who wants care is getting it. People talked about how it's easier to continue using fentanyl rather than access treatment, and that barriers to entry are high and options are often very limited. Just driving home again that people have really complex reasons for using fentanyl and multiple motivators, which really suggests they may need a range of supports and services to address these. Many people expressed not feeling like they could stop using fentanyl until either their physical pain was addressed or their homelessness or some other component of what was driving their use.
That was Allison Newman, MPH, with the Addictions, Drug, and Alcohol Institute, one of the co-authors of a new report entitled Unmet Needs, Complex Motivations, and Ideal Care for People Using Fentanyl in Washington State, a qualitative study. Find that report and many more resources on the web at adai.uw.edu. That's adai.uw.edu. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. I want to thank my guest, Haven Wheelock, from Outside In. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is
for
Doug
the
McVeigh
Drug Truth Network.
So
this is Doug
so
McVeigh
long.
Asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.